Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to YaoRadio.com, sponsored by Your Own World Books, publishers of Crossing the Cusp, Planet X Forecast and 2012 Survival Guide, and the Colburn Bible. So join us now by raising your mind to the open and locked position and buckle up for the ride. You're on Yao Radio. Welcome to Planet X Special Report. I'm your host, Marshall Masters, and this show is devoted to serving the needs of those of you who get it and want to get through it. And if you're wondering if this is your cup of tea, well then, thanks for stopping by, and may your continued surfing be safe and satisfying. But for those of you who are looking for information, you're in good company, and I know you're in one of two places. You're well along in awareness and in the middle of preparation and planning, or you're on your way to getting there. Either way, know this, there are more of you out there than you could possibly imagine, and your numbers are growing exponentially. Well, hey, this is Marshall, and I'm going to be on tonight with a dynamic team of gentlemen. They're all from the Planet X Forecast, Planet X Town Hall message board. We're going to have Ed Douglas, Richard Goodwin, and Terrell Croft on. And let me just bring them on right now and introduce them to you. Here we go. And we've got everybody online now. First off, Ed, welcome Hello. To Planet X Special Report.
Thank you.
Good to have you on, Ed. And you've been with me on Cut to the Chase and other shows. You're an administrator on Planet X Town Hall, and, man, we've been following this Comet Elenin thing for quite some time, and, well, we've both been scratching our heads on it. And we've got a new member to the board, and somebody who's really got a lot of good background on it is Richard Goodwin. Richard, welcome to Planet X Special Report. Good evening, Richard. If you could do us a favor and get a little more volume on that microphone. And then, that's a little better. There you go. And Terrell Croft. And for those of you who want to follow along and get some really good, interesting links on Comet Elenin, if you go to planetxtownhall.com and scroll on down, it's a bit way down on that homepage to my topic areas, you'll see one there called the Comet Elenin's research team, and I've got a series of links up there that Terrell sent in before showtime. And so what I wanted to do at the top of the show is first off introduce a few concepts that we're going to be using here and explain to the listeners that this is really not going to be an entertainment format. You're literally going to hear a team of researchers knocking the ideas around. There's an old adage from the Romans. It says, to the heart of such a great mystery as this, there are many roads. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to follow those different roads. We're going to do it in a structured way because my motivation for doing this series and, you know, getting these guys together and they all volunteered to help out, and I was like, wow, this is cool, is that the thing that concerns me most about Comet Elenin right now is I see oneism. A lot of people are struggling to find that one concept or idea or gotcha, whatever it is, that pulls everything together. And if there's one thing I've learned in 10 years of doing this kind of research is that's a fool's errand because it's a big universe. And it's a mighty big sky, and there could be Comet Elenin, and there could be other risks as well. And so what we always have to be mindful of is, you know, you keep one eye out there, because whatever's going to happen out there is going to happen out there. And the other eye is to look to see if there's any consequences for us for what comes from out there. And however that's going to sort itself out, it comes down to the same things. Food, water, shelter, and so forth. So in this, what I wanted to do first off is to define a couple of terms for those of you who are coming to this topic for the first time, you're really new. And a couple of simple terms, and I'm going to ask the guys to all chime in with things that they think are important terms that you should know. So when we refer to them later on in the conversation, you're not doing what we all tend to do sometimes, and that is to go, say what? You know, that's not going to help you. Now, first thing is a term called the ecliptic. And this is a real essential concept. Imagine you're in the center of the sun. Yeah, I know it's going to be a warm spot. But there you are in the center of the sun, and you just take this concentric ring and spread it out all the way through the planets, major planets in our solar system, out to the 12 constellations of the zodiac. And that is the ecliptic. And then we have below that the southern skies, and above that are the northern skies. Then there's two other terms you need to know. Aphelion, perihelion, and an object that's orbiting the sun, an elliptical orbit, its furthest distance from the sun is aphelion. In this case, this thing is, I don't know, as I understand it, it's as far out as almost a light year. But perihelion is its closest distance to the sun. And with this object, it's going to get pretty close. And those are the three terms I have. Now let me go to each of the guys. Ed, do you have a term that everybody needs to be mindful of?
Oh, geez.
You want to punt and I'll go?
Yeah, I'm going to punt on that one for now other than coma for the comet.
Okay. And
is,
a coma?
It's what we see of the comet. It's not necessarily the solid gosh, I got to see if I can explain this correctly. It's all the illuminated dust and ice and everything that we see once it gets usually inside the orbit of Jupiter.
Okay. Terrell, you got one for us?
Yes, I have a few, actually. I think the most important thing is a gravity well. The sun sits inside of a deep gravity well, the deepest in our solar system. The Earth sits inside of a gravity well. And they're connected by a gravity trough. Inside those gravity troughs are magnetic portals that connect the sun and the Earth together. Now, this object that's coming is also connected to the sun. It also sits inside of a gravity well. And the Earth passed through the connectors that connect these two suns together on 3/11 at the Japan quake. It also happened again on 2/27/2010 with the Chile quake when the Earth aquifer shifted and whenever the Earth axis shifted, and we had those giant events. And the reason is because we passed between these two stars. So that's the scientific data that says we need to be careful about the other alignments that are coming up.
Right. Okay, we got gravity wells. And later on, I'm going to ask you, too, about electrical interactions. Richard, you got one for us?
Well, I guess I'd have to say the arc minute. You'd think that would be a measure of time, but it's not. It's a measure of distance. And I won't really go into quite a bit of detail right now, but just remember that it's a measure of distance.
Okay. So we have gravity wells, which is sun's in a gravity well, Earth is in a gravity well, and when they line up, funky things happen. And we have arc minutes. And an arc minute is not about time. It's about distance. And Ed, coma, and the coma is really, well, it's when it lights up, and we're all standing out in our backyard pointing up at the sky and going, woo. We're going to see the coma, and we're going to see the tail. And also, by the way, folks, the tail of an object is, it's going to, there are different types of tails. And the one that is the bright one that goes away is gaseous. And then there's another tail which is going to be particulate. You can always tell the one that is gaseous because it goes directly away from the sun. Now, with the preliminaries done, what we need to do is get into the Comet Elenin story. And I think I'd like to get Terrell to start off and give us just a quick timeline of when this thing was discovered and where we're at right now, because there's a lot of confusion about it.
Well, it was discovered on December 10th, 2010, which became the time that we were able to get the JPL data to be able to draw up our timelines.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the timeline goes, on March the 2nd is the day that you guys are calling it a comet. I don't believe this is a comet at all. And I believe that the entire NASA story is a cover for an inbound dwarf star. I believe that's the object that we're tracking. I believe that JPL is tracking the gravity well of the inbound dwarf star, and that the objects that they see are orbitals that are orbiting inside and outside of the proton cloud that is masking this massive object. See, if this was just a comet on the alignments, we wouldn't have these events. And so,
all right.
Are you with me? I believe this is a PSYOP. I believe this is very similar to 9/11. I'm seeing a lot of the 9/11 PSYOP operations going from the intelligence agencies. And this looks like a PSYOP to me. So there's the story of the comet Elenin. That's a comet. That's inbound. And there's the story of the PSYOP. And so I'm on the PSYOP side of the equation, where others are on the comet side.
Well, I tend to be on the PSYOP side myself. That's the part of this thing that has been quite interesting for me. And I'd like to get Ed and Richard to weigh in on that. What do you guys think?
My take on it is the view of a common man. It's just a comet. That's all it is.
Okay.
But after looking at some things, of course, I do have some reservations about that statement.
Well, you know, I'm with you there. You know, I mean, I haven't heard anything here that I've disagreed with. I mean, to me, it's still answer E, all of the above. But the one thing I do agree with Terrell is I am seeing the manipulation. And that, for me, I have a good background of, you know, following this kind of stuff. And I know Terrell came out of the 9/11 side of things. And, you know, you really learn a lot about that. And I am just, there are some things that puzzle me here, because At one level, I almost feel like this could be a red herring, the way it's being used, that this object, I agree with the notion that this object is perturbing the Earth, that we're having the earthquakes as a result of this. But I'm still not sold on it being the Planet X that we've been looking for. And the question I have in my mind is Comet Elenin, this is a serious thing, and it's doing serious harm, no question in my mind. But is it being used to mask something else? Worse yet, if it comes and goes, all right, and everybody then starts saying, well, hallelujah, you know, we survived Planet X. It's never coming back again, and we're not going to give a moment's thought about it. And then all of a sudden, years later, we're in some serious, deep guacamole. But, Ed, what's your take on it?
There are so many irregularities about this whole comet. Even with the name of the gentleman that discovered it, down to we really didn't think much about this comet until, at least raised myself, until this letter came out, supposedly that was from the Russian defense minister to the Russian president about this comet, saying that they're going to have to get busy digging some more underground facilities and preparing. And they also mentioned that this comet appeared to be under intelligent control. And I believe we've been watching it sort of get steered through the asteroid belt. And also that there's a brown dwarf behind it. Or a planet. The brown dwarf part is Terrell's end of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's something where when it comes inside the orbit of Jupiter, and in our book Planet X Forecast and 2012 Survival Guide, would we believed at that time, Jacko van der Warp, is that this thing would light up. It's going to get close enough to have electrical interactions, and we're going to see it. Now, that being said, I mean, the official line is that, late summer we may be able to get up to pre-dawn hours and see it with the naked eye. Then again, there's a lot of that other stuff, and I know that the comet being under control, last I saw, that was Sorcha Fowl. Is there anyone else saying it's under intelligent control besides Sorcha Fowl?
I know the story originated with Sorcha.
Okay. All right. And by the way, Richard, I've got in the virtual chat room that our listeners are having a hard time hearing you. So if you could find a way to increase your volume, that would be real helpful.
Okay.
All right. Well, then, let's do this, guys. Let's start breaking this thing down and compartmentalizing it so we can just look at it logically. Because it's like getting a big picture puzzle, you know, tossed out of the box, and the corner pieces are missing. You know, it's like, it's just heck for Dickens to try and put a picture puzzle together without the corner pieces. And that's where we're at with this thing. So I would say the first thing is, what is the object? And I want to go with each of you, and you make your case for what you think this object is. You've already mentioned it before, but let's get this organized. So I'm going to start off with Richard.
Yeah.
What's your thinking?
Like I said, I think it's just a comet, but from some of the analysis that I've done from amateur astronomers, Gustavo was one of them. And he's been taking some great pictures of it. And, of course, I got interested in Planet X about a year ago. And 6 months later, after I've been on the Planet X Town Hall chat room, Comet Ellen was discovered. Well, that piqued my curiosity, and I followed it. And about 2 or 3 months ago, I really began looking at some of these photographs myself. And I go to whatever website I could find to get amateur astronomers' pictures, and I'd enhance them on my own. And like I say, I think it's just a comet, and it looks like a comet in pictures. But when you take some of the analysis of the length of the tail and the width of the coma, they say the coma is 1 arc minute in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And arc minute will change by distance. So 2 months from now, if they say it's an arc minute, it will not be the same figure, in my understanding. But at the time of the pictures were taken that I looked at, the coma was 80,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, started looking at some of the enhanced photos, and I could see what I think is a nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, 1 arc minute is 60 arc seconds. In some of the pictures I looked at, they would have a graph at the top, and sure enough, it's segmented into 60 segments. All right, so I look at the nucleus, and I say, okay, well, that's 3 segments. 1 segment's 9,000 miles. So if I see a nucleus that shows up as 3 segments, 3 times 9 is 27,000 miles across. Well, that doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of information I'm getting from official sources. And even
now, how does it compare? What's the official sources saying?
Well, 4 miles across is the nucleus.
Right.
So, and I'm not saying that what I'm saying is it is actually 27,000 miles across. I'm just saying that from what I see in the enhanced photos, I got a conflicting thought there. You know, it's a comet, but yet, what am I seeing here?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, this thing is just connecting the dots here is pretty tough. And let me just take a moment to tell the folks in the virtual studio. I mean, it's the virtual studio is just on fire. I can't even scroll down far enough to see the list of everyone logged on. And so I'm going to be watching in the virtual panel. So right now, if somebody has a question for Richard, put it in there, and I'll be sure to get to it. But you got to go fast.
Could I follow that up, Marshall?
Mm-hmm.
Please
do.
Okay. Well, we came across a link that is a technical paper by a scientist that submitted a paper to the European Royal Society. This guy's not playing around, okay? He's
right.
Submitting the paper to his peers to analyze and to pass for publication. And when I saw that 27,000-mile diameter, I just blew it off and said, well, I'm just seeing things. I'm looking for that paper now. Here it is.
Well, while you're looking for that, I got in the virtual studio, the user Kurto has said, it is not a comet nor just a comet, which, again, we already know it is not alone. How many comets do you know of have a tail that is 900,000 kilometers, 560,000 miles long at least?
Oh, plenty. It's not unique.
It's not unique.
No.
All right.
Even a close encountering comet like Elenin is at, 0.232 AU. I'll post a link in a minute that gives a list of about 15 different comets that have come way closer than that. So even that's
okay.
Not unique. There are some unique things I do want to bring out tonight.
All right. We're going to do that. I have a question here, and I'm going to throw it to Terrell, because I know Terrell was doing this. We got one fellow. What about Gustavo's pics that show other objects swirling about this thing? I mean, the objects that are the satellites orbiting this thing are really a hot button topic right now in the virtual studio. I'm going to throw that at Terrell.
Okay. What we're looking at is a high density dwarf star that no one can see. But they can
mm-hmm.
see the orbitals that pass in and out of the proton cloud that is shrouding this thing. So you have one person going out and seeing an orbital, that's one of the moons, and they, oh, it's a small thing. Then they see the planet, oh, it's a big thing. So we're getting conflicting reports because they're seeing different objects orbiting in and out of the proton cloud.
Okay.
Well, what you should be asking
right.
is, if this thing is that big, how come we just can't see it? This is only 1. AU distance away. It's only 180 million miles. And if it's that big, why can't we see it? If we cannot see it, it must fall in the category of just a few things. One is a dwarf star, a black star, which is theoretical, or a black hole. There's only so many things this can be to be so close and we can't see it. And it's not a comet because it has too much mass. The paper you're talking about is astronomical alignments as the cause of magnitude 6 seismicity by Mansour Omer Bashik from the European Royal Society. He dated
mm-hmm.
alignments back to 1965. This thing has been affecting our planet since 1965 with alignments and major earthquakes, 6+. The only way it can do that is if it has great mass. And it's 1.8 AU away, so it has to be only a certain number of things to be that close and that massive. And one of them is a brown dwarf star.
Well, you know, that, and I see a question here from Papa Bear One. Are we talking about the same thing visible in the South Pole? And again, he goes, what now is considered Nibiru coming in from the south during sunrise and sunset? And, of course, that question caught my attention because I'm the guy that broke the story on the South Pole telescope back in, I think it was 2006. And it was quite incidental. It was a very incidental thing. But I think it's a very pointed question. And I'm going to ask each of you guys to answer that question. Do you think that this is the object that has been under observation by the South Pole Telescope?
I'll start.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But being at the South Pole has nothing to do with this. This object is coming out of Leo. South of the ecliptic just means the lower part of Leo. It doesn't have to be on the South Pole. It's not like it's coming up from straight under the Earth. it's coming out of Leo, you know, that we can see. It's in clear space. The difference between the north and southern hemisphere, or north and south of the ecliptic, is that right at the belt of Orion running across Leo. It's not like it's going to be difficult to see because it's in the southern hemisphere. I think a lot of people have that confused, that in order to see something coming up the southern hemisphere, you have to have a telescope on the South Pole. And I don't believe that's the case. I think it's easy to control the people that are at the South Pole and the information that's coming out of there. And that's why the telescope is there, not because they're seeing anything that's coming directly under the Earth or anything like that.
Well, that's an interesting point, because there's an awful lot of secrecy about the South Pole telescope. I mean, you know, one of the things I always found interesting was I have a gentleman in New Zealand who follows and supports us, and he runs a merchant network, you know, for processing credit cards and banking and whatnot down there in New Zealand. I sure hope he didn't get, I haven't heard from him since the Christchurch quake. And he said that there was a lot of researchers that were going in and buying their provisions and supplies and whatnot, because it's New Zealand's a stop-off point for a lot of the science teams. And they were really getting annoyed with the South Pole telescope. They were saying that special C-130s on direct flights with apparently mid-air refueling were coming in from the United States directly to Scott Edmondson landing, and these teams would get off, go to the South Pole telescope for 2 weeks, not talk to anybody, and then just leave, which is really contrary to the scientific open culture of the Scott Edmondson station. So, yeah, maybe it just was a place where they could keep it pretty quiet, though. You know, that's a possibility. That's a possibility. Terrell, what's your thinking on that?
Oh, that was mine, but I had something else to say.
Oh.
This object is coming out of, right now, 56 Leo. It's between the two hind legs of Leo, and that's where it's been coming from for quite a while. They don't need a special telescope in the South Pole or anything like that in order to see it.
Okay. And, Richard, what was your thinking on South Pole telescope?
So far, I don't see where anything's coming from the south. I'm with Terrell on what he was saying. It appeared to be some kind of anomaly that has been coming out of Leo. I think I might have posted the link already in the chat room, but I did a comparison about a month and a half ago, something I stumbled upon by accident, really. I was looking at some pictures by Gustavo, and one of his pictures had what appeared to be a solar system in the background, you know, a central spot with other objects around it. And I said, well, that's really strange. That looks like a solar system. And I slept on it. The next day I woke up, and I said, you know, maybe I can find that if I go to the Google Sky. And also use a sky program called Stellarium, a great program, by the way. So I went to Stellarium, I plugged in Comet Ellen, and I got the coordinates the same night that Gustavo took his picture. I got the coordinates off of Stellarium, went to Google Sky, and typed in the coordinates. Well, I'll be doggone if that, it took me a while, it took me about an hour to look at the star patterns to finally match it up. But that, what I thought was a solar system of sorts is there in 2007. So, you know, I don't know what to say about that particular anomaly showing up and somebody saying it's a system of some kind. I just don't know. But it was there already in 2007.
Well, but the problem with all the sky programs, and we documented this on Yowza, and I think Ed could probably talk about this too, is that, man, there's just a whole lot of fabrication.
Correct.
And, you know, Ed, have you been seeing, I mean, because people always go, you know, they jump right into WikiSky and, you know, Google Sky and Microsoft, and, you know, we get a lot of stuff. And for the disinformation operatives, I mean, that's such an easy that's just an easy thing to do. Just go in and redact those databases. You get missing star panels. You fabricate stuff, make it look kind of crazy. And people just start racing down rabbit holes. And, Ed,
it's
you want to take that?
It's one of their best tools.
Yeah.
One of their best tools to get us to go down them rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the... And I guess in terms of talking about the rabbit holes, because that's what I'm really seeing. Terrell, you're seeing rabbit holes like crazy, right?
Everywhere, yeah. Disinformation, everywhere.
Well,
the thing about those all these sky programs that I don't like, and I usually don't use them much myself, is it's mostly old data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sky was scanned, you know, so long ago. We're basically dealing with old data, and which to me means it can be manipulated.
All right. Well, then, in that event, Terrell, what are you seeing?
Well, let me
in terms
add one
of disinformation. Okay.
First of all, Google Sky does have a value. It is a valuable tool. If you look at the links that are provided there, then you learn how to use a KML file and install location pins for the ELE object. So the astronomer can use the pins to identify the background markers so that he can look into the sky to try to track this thing, to be able to find one of the orbitals that's passing in and out. So there is a use for it, even though you're looking at 2007 images. So as far as the disinformation, look at Elena's name. Leonids are meteor showers that come out of the constellation Leo in November, and an ELE is an extinction level event. And this looks like code. And the 9/11 perigee and the 11/22 alignment on the backside of this, those are Illuminati numbers. That's numerology. This is 10 years after 9/11. And this is the kind of thing, these are the patterns that we're looking at that are saying this is a bunch of disinformation. And it's in your face. The reason that we got this information in 2010 is because they already have one foot in the bunkers. Now there's nothing we can do to stop their plan. They're at the point of no return. They don't care that we already know. They've already made all their plans and preparations. All the lies you're seeing with Obama's birth certificate and these wars that they're starting and Rothschild installing the central banks, and all this stuff is to keep you looking over here so you're not looking up at the sky to see this thing coming, because they do not want you prepared. When they go in their bunkers, they want this thing to kill you. We are looking at an extinction-level event coming this summer, and that's the plan. That's their real plan. So as far as they're concerned, this is checkmate, and they've already won the game.
So they just really want to get everybody paralyzed. What do you think about that, Richard? Are you paralyzed? Do you think that's what they want to do to you?
Well, I guess I just don't. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to quit my day job or anything like that. Whatever happens, happens. I only know what they're going to tell me, unless I can find stuff on my own, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay. So you're really just above the fray. What do you think, Terrell? Is it sideshow?
I'm sticking with my guns that everything is diversion that you're seeing out there. And they do want you to do everything except for get your food, get your water purification, get your survival location. I believe everyone needs to find a cavern to survive the solar storms that are going to come this summer, because the air is going to be unbreathable. And, you know, that's the way that this situation looks. Whenever two stars come together and one star comes up below the plane, right in between the sun and the earth, to break the portals that I'm talking about, the earth's going to go through a pole shift, and you're not going to want to be running around outside. So we need to take, for this particular threat, we need to take special precaution and do what the ancients did. They retreated to the caves, and that's what we need to do. That's what the elites are doing. They're going underground for a reason, because this summer things are going to get terrible.
Well, you know, I'll tell you guys, the first show I did on Planet X Special Report was with Daniel Dean. Daniel is, I went on a rather interesting canoe trip with Dan and three other fine gentlemen back in November of last year, and we were in Arkansas, and in a particular area of Arkansas where we know the top Navy brass are all retiring. And Yeah, I got the invitation just to go, and I thought it was interesting. I wanted to see what the land was like down there and why it was conducive. And I, once we paddled about 35 miles down the lower Buffalo and up the White, I had my answer. All right. And everything that they're building down there really is just, you know, they've got a lot of nice homes and retirement, but it's all above ground stuff. The real stuff is below ground. But the principal benefit that they have down there is a lot of good land and a lot of water. It's very good well location. So the question then is, for the rest of us, you know, I can see them doing that. And Dan tells me in his business, he specializes in doing power systems for bunkers. It's one of the things he does. He started his business actually taking homes off the grid and working with businesses for green energy solutions. And he's doing pretty good with that. But then he got into this network of developers who specialize in building bunkers, period. That's all they do, survival bunkers. And they're starting to get a flood of business, the likes of which they've never seen before. They can't keep up with it. One guy got over 200 bid requests in just a weekend alone. And over the years, I've sold an awful lot of books to people who have called me and asked me about general locations because they were going to get a cave. And although it seems the most favored thing for a lot of them are these missile silos. They seem to be pretty popular because they're pretty deep and pretty hardened. So I've seen this as a general trend, but the bunker building right now is at a frantic pace, such likes we've never seen before. And to put this in perspective for the listeners out there, these people are plunking down a minimum of $500,000 to build these bunkers. And these things are just nice, comfortable condo townhouse feel kind of things with complete independence off the grid. You know, they have their own air, water, waste. I mean, it's all self-sufficient, all designed to survive for 6 months to a year. They're stockpiling a lot of food. I see that, and it makes me sad because I see people who have the money and have the contacts are busting the moves, and there's nothing reticent or bashful about it. But for people out in the mainstream, they're just not waking up in the big numbers. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. You know, I'd like to ask each of you guys what you're seeing out there amongst people that you know, just personally within your own network. I'm going to start with Ed. Have you seen people building bunkers, Ed?
No, not here in Ohio. Okay. We're flat ground USA here, and the highest place in Ohio is 1,300 foot above sea level,
mm-hmm.
and that's not going to go a whole long way here. I know if I have any advance notice in that, I'm heading east toward the Appalachian Mountains, but most people here in Ohio seem to be oblivious to what's going on. There's so many, how you say, personal battles being fought here for people trying to find a way to make a living, and so many unemployed people, et cetera, et cetera. And very few people, probably about the only person I really know that is interested at all in doing something like that is my own brother. And he's right along with this stuff, and then even friends of me and my brothers don't believe in it. And people here are kind of stubborn, I guess.
Yeah, boy, ain't that the truth. I understand how it is. I mean, I just spent the last 3 months getting myself relocated for 2012 and to a more survivable situation. And, man, you sure get a lot of flack. But on the other hand, where I'm at and my new neighbors, they find out what it is that I do. And, I find it's different. I find people out in the country are more open-minded to this than people in the city. I think that's just a part of, we live in a just-in-time economy. You know, everybody, if you need it, just go to Kmart and look for the flashing blue light. That goes that way. Richard, what are you seeing with bunkers?
No, I haven't heard
of anything. You seeing anybody doing anything, planning, setting aside supplies or anything?
No, not as far as bunkers. Now, I have read in the local paper that the sales of emergency power units have taken off. Of course, I live in Hurricane Alley, so that might be a reflection of that more than anything else. But somebody I talked to, they shy away from talking about stuff like this. You know, they have a wife and family to worry about, and they just don't. They're not worried about it, as in the days of Noah.
Yeah. You know, the question is how many people would have enough common sense to go up to Noah when he was building the ark and say, you got anything available in the way of a stateroom above the waterline? Or, here's a shocker, you know, can I help? People are. Carol, what about you? Are you seeing people really getting serious about their planning, or they're doing that I'll cross that bridge when I come to it dance?
No, the members I help in our survival groups, we have meetup videos. There's a meetup video in those links. And the people join us, and we're using natural underground bunkers. We're using caves and caverns with water supplies. We're going to need that for about 3 months. During the summer, before and after the pole shift. That's our plan.
Well, now we're seeing the government closing these caves, so what's going to happen there?
Well, you're going to commandeer what you need. You identify the threat, and you create the contingency plan, and you execute the plan when you need to. It doesn't matter if there's you break the door down, and you get in the cavern whenever the time comes. The solar storms are going to get really terrible, and whenever you see that happening, you better find yourself a cavern. It's not going to be good enough to dig a hole behind your house. It's not going to be good enough. You're not going to have enough air to be able to survive. We're talking about an extended event. This is ELE event.
Yeah, I agree with Terrell.
You're going to have to really prepare.
Yeah, the radiation is, when we were writing Planet X forecasts and 2012 survival guide, we really focused real heavily on that. Jacco van der Warp was as a Dutch physicist, his specialty was in radiation and dealing with how it affects the body. That was his specialty. Worked in hospitals, and he was the whole thing was you got to get as much earth, steel, whatever mass as you can above your head. I mean, in general, if you have about 8 feet of dirt over your head, that's where you start to get your protection. In your case, Terrell, yeah, how deep are you digging?
If you can't find
a cave.
I work with several groups, and our cavern is 40 miles deep. That's been discovered so far. I mean, that's as far as it's been explored, but it's very big. And we don't need 40 miles deep, but we need the air. We need the air and the water resources that are underground.
Yeah, air is really important. And resources. You know, years ago, I had a gentleman on Cut to the Chase. And, gosh, I think this was back in 2004 or 2005, had up in Idaho the largest remaining hard rock silver mine for lead and silver. And, you know, the funny thing was when the EPA did the testing of his mine, they said it was poisoning the children in the town, and what they found was that the children in the town actually had less lead in their system than kids living anywhere in any suburb of any major city, Chicago, New York, or whatever. And the EPA was using its extrajudicial powers to literally steal his mine away from him. And then when I was asking him, well, what has this mine really got in terms of that they would want, and he said it's a perfect bunker. It's 7 levels deep. It's got electrical, plumbing, railway. It's got offices. It's got everything, full working mine. But he said the kicker was that the lower 2 levels of the mine were completely flooded with pure artesian water. And, you know, the EPA glommed on to that, and they just stole it from them. And a lot of people don't realize the EPA actually is extrajudicial. It means that they can just do whatever they want. And if they serve the papers on you, they can open up your life like a tin can. You don't have any constitutional rights. You know, it's like, you know, they can't, they can go in, open up anything in your life, go to anybody you talk to, force them to compel information. The powers of the EPA, as I learned it, were just breathtaking. So, yeah, I mean, if they're going out and doing that, Terrell, you're doing, you're building your group is going 40 miles underground. And that's an important thing. You know, Papa Bear sitting here saying, be 8,000 feet and deep in the mountain. You know, so Papa Bear is wearing belts and suspenders there. And, of course, there's always the hydroponics. You know, it's interesting. I'm seeing, as we're talking here, guys, I'm looking at the virtual room, and it is just, they're just on fire there. You know, and one of the big questions right now I see is, how will one grow food in a cavern? And since you seem to be the cavern go-to guy right now, Terrell, how do you do that?
I'm bringing 1,200 pounds of vacuum-packed rice and every kind of bean you can name and canned goods, and we're talking truckloads of stuff.
Okay. So you guys are really – are you setting aside supplies for people that – well – you'll pick up along the way, or is it just you and yours?
You have to have supplies to join our group. You run out of food, you're out of the group. That's the rule.
Wow. That is tough. So you guys really, I mean, let me ask you, if worst comes to worst, and somebody's been sitting hunkered down there with you for 6 months and they run out of food, are you really going to throw them up on the top? Do you think you could do that?
Those are the rules. This is survival.
Those are the rules.
The people with a survival mentality will bring enough food. Those that do not will not survive. If you don't respect this ELE object that's coming in, it's going to kill you.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. I definitely agree with that. Well, you know, what I'd like to do now is let's look a little bit into the future. You know, here we're here in that three-ring tent, three-ring. And the third ring is the future. And let's look at it month by month as to what you think or what you're looking for to see coming our way. And let's start in June. Let's start with Richard. What do you think is going to happen in June, Richard?
I think we're going to start seeing things pick up. Even though I'm a proponent of it's just being a comet, there's some unique things about Ellen that just don't add up or that are unique enough to pique my curiosity. One of them is the fact that it's really kind of rare for a comet to come through on the ecliptic like it is. There have been others, but they're rare. And it's coming through the ecliptic, and it's threading the needle right through the asteroid belt. And the fact that it might be bigger than what we think it is. But I think things are going to pick up. If Comet Ellen is not a comet, we're going to start seeing major changes, Earth changes.
Okay, well, like what? Give us some examples.
Oh, well.
What are you going to be? Well, I tell you what, let's not do that. Let me just say, you're expecting more activity, an increase in Earth changes and catastrophic Earth changes. In June.
Yes, if it's something other than a comet.
If it's something other than a comet. So
right
if
now,
it is
a comet.
All right. So then what you're thinking is in June, if we're not seeing an uptick in natural disasters,
then
it may not.
A comet.
Then it's just a comet. All right. Well, okay. That's good. We got that. Ed, what do you think? What's up for you in June?
Well, I can say that New Zealand had a nice big tornado today, and they don't have tornadoes down there.
Okay.
And, so we are seeing anomalies all over this planet. I'm wondering if by June, if NASA will finally decide to take a picture of the comet. And if they
do, come on, Ed, you know that they got more pictures than Kodak's got film. I mean, it's just, it's not that they can't observe it.
Nobody.
Well, it's one thing.
To anybody, and
it's one thing to get them.
Two different stories.
That's right. You know, I mean, NASA just reminds me of Playboy for Married Men. You ever heard of that, Playboy for Married Men? Same picture every month, you know.
NASA is very frustrating. And, I mean, if anybody's expecting help from NASA, boy, you know, we're looking the wrong way. But they've even given two different opinions about this. One was that it was going to miss by 40 million miles, and the other one was we can't guarantee it's not going to hit the Earth. And,
wow. Talk about you having your cake and eating it, too.
Yeah, they said it both ways.
Good Lord.
And, somebody came up on the NASA Buzz Room, and from what I understand, normally it's people that are NASA-related that were on their Buzz Room, and said they had recalculated the orbit and all that, and that it was going to come within 0.000-4617 AU. Which works out to about 37,000 miles, which in space is a direct hit. They closed the Buzz Room down March 6th, and it hasn't opened since. That's a little peculiar. And
I hope to shut
up. Any acknowledgement of this rascal.
So in June, what do you expect to see? Or what are you going to be looking for in June?
I'm going to be looking. I think we're going to see more of what we got right now. I think we're going to have
more
tornadoes and storms that are just seem to be getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I might throw one thing in on this. I don't know. I'd like to know what the other guys think about it too. Is, well, you even ran a story on it. Is when the Gulf conveyor was basically cut off due to the BP oil spill. And that kept the Gulf from getting rid of its heat. And so the Gulf is very warm right now, and I think we're seeing the results of that due to the fact of all this moisture that's coming up here from the Gulf. And it's just flooding the whole eastern half of the country. And and the conveyor is still looped out. I mean, all we got is a loop for the Gulf, and that's it.
Well, I think we're coming up for the peak period for tornado season, right?
Yes.
And, you know, excuse me, fellas, the cell phone, I just have to turn that off.
I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, trust me, it was not NASA calling. Okay, so we're going to see more of these. We're just going to see a lot more of these things coming on. Now, in terms of June, so far, Ed is expecting more natural disasters. Richard's saying if it's a comet and it's just a comet, then it's going to, things are just going to continue on as they have been continuing on. And if Terrell is going to want to jump in now, I'm sure he's going to spice it up. So have at it, Terrell.
Okay. The situation we have now is that Earth crossed ELE orbit on April the 25th. We crossed orbit, and now we've matched orbit. That means that we're on the same side, and that closing, there's no closure for the next almost 2 months. We're at 1.8 AU away, and we're going to remain at that distance. Whenever we come up on the 12th of this month, that's the day that we actually get further away from this object. What happens is, see those gravity portals I was talking about, those magnetic portals? As this thing gets closer to the sun, those portals become, they shrink towards perigee, and they grow in diameter. That's giving this object the ability to influence our planet more and more because it's extending portals onto our planet. Okay, but the distance is not shrinking. The distance is actually growing a little bit. So we're going to see Earth magma. That's what we're really looking at here, Earth magma heating up. Well, the heating process is going to moderate, and there's going to be a lot of of harmonics with flow, but I don't see an increase in the earth changes through this period that's coming up through June. What we do have, the month of May has a lot of planetary alignments. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars are all on the same side, and they're lining up pretty well, so we could see some action from that. Otherwise, the important event on my timeline is July the 7th. That's whenever we have a Sun, ELE, Saturn alignment. That's whenever the portals to Saturn should be broken. We should have a sign from Saturn. Then the Earth changes on the Earth are going to begin increasing at the middle part of August. That's when the closure, if you run the JPL program, you're going to see closure really, really coming fast. That closure is when those portals are shrinking towards the Earth, and this object has the ability to really influence the Earth. And so the Earth changes are going to become dramatic. The closure on the Sun is also happening, and so the solar storms are going to really intensify, and it's on the left side. That's bad for the Earth. This thing has a negative 5 declination on perigee at 9/11, but it has a 0 declination at the alignment on 9/26, so it's coming up from the ecliptic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this object is directly between the Earth and the Sun on the plane on the 26th. That's the most dangerous day of all, because that's when the portals are broken and we have the chance for that pole shift. But the thing that's going to drive us underground is going to be the solar storms, because this object coming in from the left is going to pull out those flares. Those flares are going to turn to storms, and everything's going to turn really, really bad in the weeks leading up to September the 26th. So possibly even 2 weeks before that. So my plans are to head to my bug-out location around August the 1st. Between August the 1st, the first 2 weeks there, you're still going to be able to get to your location. But instead of timing this event, what we're timing is everyone's reaction to it. If everyone woke up today, if everybody in the world heard this show and they believed every word I said, they would all get ready and you wouldn't be able to prepare. So the fact that you are awake and they aren't gives you the opportunity. And you have to wake up and get to your safe zone and into your cavern before everybody else wakes up. Because if everybody wakes up before you, you're not going to get there. You catching my drift there? And 2012 is the cover story. You keep saying 2012, but this is happening in 2011. 9/11 perigee this year is when the event happens, not 2012. That's the Intelligence Community Disinformation Program, 2012. The last day on the calendar is actually October 28th, 2011. Everybody thinks it's 2012, but it's not. It's actually in conjunction with these events that's happening right here in 2011, not 2012.
All right. So for you, it's you're not seeing anything in June that's a wake-up call other than what we're seeing right now with current patterns. And you see that coming a little later on. But I still want to step through this month by month. So, and the virtual studio is on fire with this topic. One fellow says, where's the safest place on the planet to be? And that's one question that we have there, and I think let me just, for those of you that are looking for that place in the June time frame, where would you go, Ed?
If I had the resources and the ability to do so, I would probably head to northwest Canada, over toward Alaska. Matter of fact, I even think we have some people on the town hall from there.
Yeah, we do. We do. And to Richard, I got a comment here in the virtual studio that I think is interesting from a Boris. And what he's asking is, from what I hear, we still have plenty of ifs and keep talking basically in circles. What do you think? Is all of this really just getting everybody to talk in circles there, Richard?
I don't think so. I think it helps to talk about it. Even if it does go in a circuit, our conversations, it reiterates some of our points that we're trying to make.
That
we just don't know exactly what's going to happen. But if it is something big like Nibiru or a big object, when things happen, it's going to happen quick, fast, and you better be where you're going before it gets there.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. All right, so here's the tally for June. Ed believes we're going to have a continuing increase in the Earth changes. Richard, I believe your position is if it is more than a comet, we'll see an increase. If not, possibly not. And for Terrell, it's still sideshow, that the big ticket items are going to come later on. So with that, let's move from June to July. All right. And let me start this off with Richard. What would you expect to see in July, assuming it's a comet or assuming it's more than a comet, Richard?
Well, you know, things will just get worse as time goes on. That's just the way the picture is painted. Now, we know the next alignment.
Well, how do you define getting worse?
More earthquakes. I think we'll see, we'll see weather changes, yes, but I think we'll see some strange things, you know, just earthquakes where they should not be. Maybe even in New Madrid, who knows? Maybe that's something that's coming up. If that thing has some kind of a magnetic property to it, which there's talk in scientific circles that it might, you know.
There is. I've been seeing that too. I'm tracking it too. There's a lot of concern about New Madrid.
Well, that's one of the points that even though I say it's a comet, I am seeing things that, you know, make me want to get on the fence. So, no, as far as July, I think we'll see progressively worse.
Okay. Ed, what do you think for July?
Well, I think people better be busy little beavers getting everything ready by August 1st. I think Terrell and I have the same time frame. If you're not ready by August 1st, you're going to be in deep trouble. And I think July
Serious
is going to make
voodoo.
It difficult to prepare.
That's a new add to the dialogue. And in terms of making it more difficult to prepare, what do you expect to see along those lines?
Well, I think we're already starting to see a planetary food shortage.
Uh-huh.
Watching the food prices, that supply and demand is kind of telling me that there's some shortages out there.
Uh-huh.
Those are going to continue to get worse with all the flooding and the fires and everything else. So food might start either, one, out being too high-priced or being difficult to get. And then even having the ability to go get it due to, I think the world's going to start going a little crazy in July. And we're going to shake, rattle, and roll.
Well, when the world's going crazy, are you talking, you know, terrestrially or politically?
Yes.
Or okay.
I can almost say all of the above. But
really.
Politically,
I keep going to that one, you know. Yeah, I keep finding myself that I always keep checking off all of the above anymore. Terrell, now you said in June, so what? August, the guacamole hits the fan. But what are you seeing for July?
Actually, the guacamole hits the fan in September. August is your last chance to get to your location. July, the closing rate is 1.7 AU to 1.5, so it's still not dramatic yet. We're looking for the sign on July the 7th. It's very important. That's a very important day, July the 7th, that we're going to watch Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to give us a sign. But that's the only day that's on my timeline for July. And so I see much of the same, that we have this object is closing on the sun more and more, so that gravity portal is getting smaller. I think we're going to see reports from the scientists that the magnetic poles are moving at a very, very, very fast rate. About this time, they're going to be saying that a pole shift is happening, but the poles are not shifting; they're migrating because this object is trying to make the Earth one of the hosts of its mini solar system. So that influence, that magnetic influence, is going to increase dramatically. So we're going to see magnetosphere disruption. You're going to see those animal deaths. The reason animal deaths are happening is because the migrating animals have magnetite in their tissues, and they're following lines that are disrupted, and they're going to the wrong places between food supplies. And so by the time they get there, either their food source didn't get there or they're in the wrong place and they swim around in circles until they just perish.
Yeah, and you know, there was I have a lot of friends down in Los Angeles, and I'm really worried for them because there have been two massive fish kills down there. And I mean, the fish floating on the surface, it's so thick, you almost think you could just get out and walk across it. And if it's one isolated incident, you know, maybe they could rationalize it away, but there's fish kills happening all around the world. And birds falling out of the air, there's a lot of this going on. And, yeah, but still the same. You turn on, you know, the network television and they give you the happy noise. Don't worry about it. You know, they just ran out of oxygen. You know, it's like, oh, it's okay. Everything just ran out of oxygen and died. You know, that's normal. That's cyclical, or however they like to explain it. And that just doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work for me. So what you're seeing then for July is we're going to see a lot more of these fish kills, a lot more animal die-offs. Are we going to continue to see a heavy degradation in terms of the bee populations? Einstein said, when the bees go, so do we, and the bees are going.
Right, because they're getting lost. They're not finding them dead around their hives. They're going out and following these magnetic lines, and they're getting lost, and then they can't make it back to their hives, and so they're just dying.
Yeah, yeah.
All these animals are getting lost this year. See birds flying the wrong way and for winter and everything else.
Okay. So then, did I miss anyone for July?
I think you got us all.
Okay. All right. So then, basically, July is about the last month we're all going to have to start setting things aside and stockpiling. And I think that if there's one point that you listeners out there take away from this conversation about July, is that, and because this is what I am seeing. I've really, especially in the last year, I have become far more earth-centric, if you will, in my view of, I'm just seeing what is happening on the earth, because that's really going to drive the issue that is near and dear to my heart, survivability. And what we're going to see is a contraction of oil infrastructure from natural disasters. It's not going to be about a shortage of oil, all the oil we need. But it is a contraction of the infrastructure. I'm talking about terminals, refineries, and so forth. And Katrina 2005, excellent example, folks. Think about it. Go back to 2005. Pull out your tax returns and all your receipts. Look what you were spending for gas and food after Katrina. It all spiked up. Why? Not because there was a shortage of oil. There was a shortage of oil infrastructure. And it's really important for y'all to understand that, you know, if farming was done today the way it was done up to, you know, World War II, and we could feed maybe 2.5-3 billion people tops. So really, the majority of people living on the planet today are here because of something artificial. And it's called petroleum-based agribusiness. And part of that green revolution that kicked in back in the 1950s with petroleum-based fertilizers, petroleum-based pesticides. And think about it. Next time you go to the store, you know, I was a kid. I can still remember when I was a kid, and you can, boy, I'm going to show some gray hair here. But when it was time for apples, I'd go to the store, and there were like 20 different kinds of apples, all grown local farms, and they were just all absolutely exquisite, just delicious. You could pick those things up and just smell them, and they smelled so good to make you hungry. Today you go in, you don't have so many varieties, and where they're coming from, South America and all these other places, if stuff's coming in, you know, it's truck ripened fruit. And you pick it up and you go to smell it, you really don't smell much. And, you know, you bite into it. A lot of times it just doesn't taste that good. It just looks pretty, sits on the shelf nice. Well, all of that's oil infrastructure. That's the reason why we have it in our stores. And the other thing people have to understand is with merchandising and just in time is that we're on, you may think there's an awful lot of inventory in the stores, and there is. But next time you're in the fruits and vegetables department, produce department, look in those displays, the ones where you see like all of those fruit crates stacked up, all right? And then on top of that is your apples and your oranges and whatever. Well, all of that stuff is what you see is what you see. Below it is nothing but cardboard. That's it. But you have that sensation of, wow, it's really something. And what I see coming, guys, it's going to bite people in the tuchus, is the ghost of Y2K past, the millennium bug. Now, you know, there's a lot of people who laugh at that and they think it's a non-event. I remember Michio Kaku went on to warn about solar storms. And he was ridiculed on Fox by the news entertainer and saying, wow, this is just another one of these, you know, Y2K scares. Well, I'm going to tell you something. I worked in the computer industry for well over two decades. And in my last 6 years, I specialized in Internet technologies, not the part where you see when you log in. I was the guy that was documenting and doing analysis on systems that were in that black hole on the other side of your modem. It just, things kind of work mysteriously, and it gets there. Well, that was what I was immersed in. That's what I understood. And the real threat of Y2K, and by the way, Y2K was a Titanic that did not hit the iceberg. Period. I know. I worked in it. I actually documented the Achilles heel of the national computing grid that really had everybody scared to death. I was hired to do that by Hewlett-Packard. It's called messaging.
Well, Marshall, they saved the day in the nick of time, didn't they? So did
they? Well, you know, I mean, Y2K, people don't understand that before computer automation, you know, imagine you go to the store, you go to get a box of cornflakes. You take it up, scan it, go home, unpack it, get in front of the TV, you know, you pour a bowl and you put some milk in there and you take a big munchy bunch and watch Dancing with the Stars. Well, by the time, from the time you picked it off the shelf and put it on the scanner to the time you're sitting there munching in your first bowl of cereal in front of the Dancing with the Stars, a whole series of computers have had a long conversation about it, and it's completely automated. There's no human intervention. The store talks to its local office. The local office talks to wholesalers and distributors, and then they talk on to other computers, and that all of this stuff is incrementally done until finally Kellogg's or wherever you got your cornflakes from understands that they got to replace that one box that you just bought off the shelf. And how does it all work? Well, it's called supply chain management. And what it really means is before computers, Kellogg's and other companies knew that they had to have a 90-day supply of food in the distribution chain, because it was all manual and it was all inefficient. And it was had to be like a big slinky that could pick up the slack. And why is that? Because shelf space is absolutely paramount. You know, go back on Google and look at pictures of grocery stores from the 60s and the 50s. And the first thing you notice is that the shelves were half as high as they are now. They didn't stock anywhere near the inventory because everything they needed was out in the supply chain. But now the supply chain is no longer 90 days. It's 90 hours. That's it. 90 hours, not 90 days. And so what happens is that all it takes is a few vital computers to go down. And then at that point, then they're just simply no longer going to be working. All right? The whole grid goes down. think of it like you got a banquet table, all right? And there on the banquet table, you got every kind of goodie for dinner. And then somebody comes and they kick out one leg of the table. That's it. You got the other three legs going, but they kick out the other leg of the table. And what happens? Next thing you know, you're eating off the floor. That was the whole thing of Y2K that had all these companies scared. There was enough money spent on Y2K to finance a major war in the Middle East. And these checks were written by people that not only wear belts and suspenders to work, but they wear two pairs of them because they understood. And after Y2K, you know, you had, yeah, everybody was expecting airplanes to fall out of the sky and nuclear reactors to blow up. Well, that didn't happen. Why? Because it was all nonsense that was pitched to the American people by gold and silver brokers. The nuclear reactor is going to blow up. Buy gold. That was it. These were the guys that were panicking people. All right? But the real panic was all you needed was a couple of these critical computers using all these automated messaging systems to just fold up because of Y2K issues. And the whole system comes down. At that point, our railroad system, which there are no more manual switches, they're all computer-controlled electronic switches. We'd have had most of our produce, meats, vegetables, whatnot, sitting on abandoned rail sidings while everyone tried to sort things out and dusting off the old manual procedures. It could have thrown the country into a depression. And it was a real serious threat. And yet, after all was said and done, the people who sounded the alarm and actually did the right things were crucified. You know, I mean, that was when, you know, Bill O'Reilly and I parted company. Yeah, you know, off with their heads, you know, and he just was really ripping them. And I'm going, man, didn't you ever bother to do one stitch of homework? Not one stitch of homework. Well, the heroes were all kicked in the teeth for Y2K, but it was a Titanic didn't hit the berg. But the problem is the very same vulnerability still exists today. That's
even
what people don't understand. Absolutely. It's a just-in-time environment. And what people don't understand is that most of the inventory in the system is sitting on the shelves in the store. And when that's gone, that's it. And what you're going to have is like when you have major storms and they're just going in and pulling up. You know, people just take everything out of the store, and when there's nothing left, they start taking out shelvings and ripping up floor tile because they get crazy. They get crazy. And so I think that, you know, all of you guys have made the point right. I mean, this is for people really seriously to start doing it now. Because right now, 99% of the people out there are busy watching Dancing with the Stars, folks. That's it. They're just watching Dancing with the Stars and thinking, well, I'm not going to worry about it. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. And then they're going to go out and think that it's all going to be there at Costco and at Walmart and whatnot. No. It'll be there for 90 hours.
They're tuned into that just-in-time stuff then.
That's right. They're completely programmed to it. You know, and it's just something which I've come to realize is the reason why it's so hard to find people who are really going to seriously, you know, start planning to do things. All right? That's why it's so hard to find people to, because we are programmed now with just-in-time thinking. And, you know, the problem is, when the guacamole hits the fan, everyone's going to race to the store, and then that's it. It's down to a trickle. And, you know, I did traveling in Russia after it opened up in the 90s, and I saw those long lines. I was in stores where you'd see an entire meat case wall to wall. All these refrigerated meat cases were just empty, and there'd be one ham sitting there. And it was old.
I hate to interrupt you, Mark. You said
cost
you were in Russia. You saw that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw that.
Yeah, I remember those
really nice
lines. I remember seeing it on TV or in the paper.
Yeah.
Empty shelves.
Yeah, empty shelves. empty
now,
shells. People have no idea.
With Katrina's mm-hmm. a good thing to look at if you want to know what society is going to be like in a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as far
I agree.
As, yeah, it's a good example. You know, it's just chaos. There was nothing here, no infrastructure. Couldn't get water. Couldn't get anything. If a store was open, you better be lucky and glad that you got there and they had something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if anything happens, it'll be chaos, I guarantee you.
Yeah.
Well, they were warned it was coming, and they talk about the dancing with the stars syndrome. They knew how many days in advance it was coming and how many people still got trapped in New Orleans.
Well, I think those are some unfortunate people. A lot of them, they didn't even have a vehicle to get anywhere.
Yeah,
you're right. There's a lot of people that stayed.
And I got a dollar, I can get on a bus.
Well, that's true, but, you know, I don't know what to say to that, but I think a lot of them were unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, guys, what I want to do in the time remaining is I want to give each of you some time with the audience. Just take about 5 minutes each, and what you feel are the major concerns for August and September beyond. I think everyone can kind of see it coming, but let's just take it one at a time. And let's start with Richard.
Well, once again, things are just going to get worse. Multiplied. That's if it's anything other than a comet. I don't know how deep you want me to go into it, but there are things on the internet that even get me to thinking. You know, even as a prudent man, that, you know, I refuse to believe it's anything else until I start seeing more actually happening. The closer it gets, the more I'll know. Now, I'll tell you, there's some things that really confuse me. Why is NASA just kind of ignoring it? And it could be that within the next couple of months that the major news stations will start covering this thing. Maybe NASA will put out some information. But right now, they're just mum. They've got 1,300 observations on this thing. As far as orbital elements, you can't tell me that they cannot tell me how big it is. They got radar they can see that far. They take radar and measure asteroids. So why can't they take one of their pieces of equipment? Oh, actually, it's an array of radar. They look at it from different places around the world, and they put the images together. There's no way that NASA does not know how big this thing is. By golly, put it on their web page, and it'll shut me up.
Are you holding your breath?
No. But no, in August, I expect things to pick up. It's just going to get chaotic if it's anything other than comet. That's all I can say. Time goes by, it's going to get progressively worse.
That's it. It's just going to get worse. And, Ed, what's your last thoughts on it?
Well, I believe if anybody's planning on getting prepared, they should by August 1st. I believe supplies might be in short supplies. We never know when we're going to have geomagnetic problems here, and we don't have electricity anymore. I always have that in the back of my mind, and who's going to deliver anything? And only thing you're going to get is if you can walk to a store and get it and carry it home. And when it's gone, it's gone. So if you haven't prepared in advance, you know, you're going to do without. I mean, originally we were thinking December 21st, 2012 on this. And I know Terrell mentioned earlier about October 28th. 2011, which was one of the theories of when the Mayan calendar ends. And maybe they faked us out, and it is 2011. And I think August is going to start getting, well, heck, people get nasty toward that time of the year anyway because they're tired of the heat, tired of the humidity, especially back east here. Anytime they ever had a riot in a major city, it was during that time period.
Yeah, it gets hot and sticky.
Yeah, you know, and people get aggravated at each other, and they're just in a horrible mood. And then on top of this, we're going to have a whole big bunch of mess going on. And then going into September, oh, boy.
Yeah. So, I mean, the timing is basically this is the summer. And, Terrell.
Yes, sir.
Take us to August and September and,
okay,
frankly, the rest of this year. And
August
move us through that, because I think we've gotten the point across to everybody. If you get it and want to get through it, you know, start getting your stuff. Get squared away.
August is an exciting month. If you're watching this object, you're at Earth orbit around August 1st. Around August 18th, you're already at Venus orbit, and at the end of the month, you're at Mercury orbit. So this thing is really moving. Okay, the Earth is swinging around. The Earth is swinging around on the far side. All these umbilicals, all these magnetic portals are shrinking, giving this object the ability to influence our planet even more. So you got this is the month that I'm on the move to get to where I'm going. The solar storms are getting much worse by this time. The you have perigee 9/11. The 19th is the day that the dwarf star is equal distant from the sun and the earth at only 0.523 AU from the earth, leading up to the September 26th alignment. That's whenever the object comes right on the plane between the sun and the earth. That's when we expect a pole shift to happen. See, the pole shift, what actually happens is this is like a giant magnet coming in and taking polarity control from the sun. What happens is the North Pole is the pole that's moving the most. When you look at the two poles, the North Pole is moving the most, telling us that the North Pole of this object is repelling our North Pole. That tells me that the North Pole is going to be facing directly away, not flip, not turn 90 degrees, but the Northern Hemisphere is going to be pointing away from the two stars, giving us over a week of night. The Southern Hemisphere is going to be exposed to the storms. The Northern Hemisphere is going to be protected. And that's why the prophecies, in my opinion, are all written to the peoples of the Northern Hemisphere. And then on October 2nd is the next major. The dwarf star crosses Venus orbit again at only 0.316 AU from the Earth. October 17th is the day that this object is only 0.232 away, or 21 million miles. That's the nearest point in the encounter. Now, a lot of people are talking about, well, we're going to go through the tail then because they're thinking comet, but this is not a comet. It has orbitals. But whenever you run the charts, and you draw all the orbits, and you see where they all cross, the chances of one of these objects striking us is very, very remote. The chances are that they're going to be affected gravitationally and magnetically severely, but we're not actually going to be hit by one of these objects. Then on November the 14th, the dwarf star crosses the Mars orbit at 0.46 away. By this time, this object is climbing high above the plane, so an alignment is not as severe whenever it's not an exact alignment. And then on November 22nd is the final alignment, the third alignment on my chart, and it's only 0.58 away, but it's high above the plane. So I do expect something to happen March the 11th, a similar event like Japan, a similar event because this object is going to be so close. And then this object begins orbiting outside of our we'll be able to come out of our caves by then. The reverse pole shift takes place because what happens is the sun regains polarity control from this object. This object, when it's directly in position between us, is going to gain polarity control and cause that flip backwards. But then as it moves away, then the sun is going to regain the polarity. And I believe the magnetic pole that we have now is going to be very similar to where it is right now, so that the Earth is going to flip back north and south pretty close to where we are now. However, this thing has a deep gravity well and is going to lead us in orbit. It's going to pass us in front, which means our orbit could speed up and cause our year to become shorter from this event, maybe back to 360 days rather than 365, like in the ancient times.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it's interesting you mentioned that because the formation, the Avebury 2008 formation, I document in my book, Crossing the Cusp, shows this object coming in about the place where you say it is going to be seen and doing its worst to us. So there's an awful lot of convergence. But in general, I think for the listeners out there to sort through all of this, there's a lot of injected confusion. And the problem with all of this injected confusion in the topic is that it just gets one foot nailed to the floor. And then you wonder why you keep seeing the same scenery, because you're not going anywhere. And chewing through it and trying to get to the heart of the matter, well, it's like going down a muddy country road. You get your tire caught in a rut, and sure enough, boy, you're spinning the wheels and the engine's going roar and you're burning gas and you really think you're doing something. But the fact is, you're not going anywhere. You're still in the rut. And the best way to deal with that road is to get down it, not to get stuck in it. And there's one message that's come through from everybody on this panel, is that it's time to get out of the rut. It's time to get on down the road and get yourself prepared. And I think that is the real big message. And I would invite those of you listening in, you can go to planetxtownhall.com and scroll way on down to where you see Marshall Masters and the headings. And under there, I have a topic that is for this Comet LNN research team. We're going to continue to follow it. And we're not planning to do scheduled shows because this is really a research effort. This is an independent group of guys, and we're just sorting through all of this information and sharing it with you. And you've got to decide what you're going to do about it. And that's the final analysis on that. And as things develop, as the story develops, we'll come on and we're going to do more of these shows. This is going to be an ongoing series, but we're not going to schedule it, because the minute you schedule it, that's entertainment. And we're not about entertainment here, folks. We are about survival. And so with that, a last thought from each of you. And Ed, you first.
Well, may I ask one quick question of Terrell?
Sure. Sure.
Because none of us brought it up, but with a pole shift and things like that, do you expect tectonic plate shift?
Absolutely. The magma is heating up now, gradually, but as this thing gets closer and closer, magma is going to really, really heat up, and the harmonics you have now is the magma is finding equilibrium, and so the entire Yellowstone caldera is rising. You've got entire caldera is rising. And what's happening is the tectonic plates are going to begin floating. The Earth is actually growing. And then this thing comes in and terraforms the whole thing. That's what's going to happen.
Now, do you believe the Schumann resonance has something to do with this also?
You would have to bring me up to speed.
The frequency of our Earth, basically, the best way to put it, the resonant frequency, I guess they call it the Schumann resonance. I know it was at 8 hertz a few years ago, and we've gained about 50% on that, which we start thinking differently the way we operate. But
Ed?
I was wondering if you figured that might have something to do with it also.
But those are symptoms. Those are symptoms of another star coming in, trying to make our planet a part of its solar system. So it's trying to wrestle polarity control from our sun.
Okay, so yeah, we have tectonic movement to look forward to also then. Oh boy.
Yeah,
that's the way I felt about it also. My last comments, Mr. Masters, would be I think people better stock up on food, water. Not a bad idea to find a way to filter water. They might want to plan on ways to cook food and heat themselves if there's no electricity. I think if I lived near a coastline, I might consider moving.
Mm-hmm.
An ocean coastline. If you live by a pond, no, you know. But I think I'd get an escape route planned if I lived near the coastline and use it when the time comes. Don't wait till the last minute. When if you even have an inkling it's time, go. And otherwise you're going to get caught in the traffic. And then the last point I might make is, you hate to think about it, but the way things might get, people might want to start thinking about self-defense and weaponry.
Yeah, and that's going to even get more difficult in time. The most important thing with that is keep it simple, because it's going to be real hard to find a gunsmith.
Yeah.
You know, and just remember, it's the point of contact with the pistol or rifle. It's the caliber. You want something that's popular. And with whatever knife you're going to get, it's the edge. Everything else is accessory. But it's that edge. How well it cuts, how well it takes an edge, how well it holds up. And those are definitely the important things. Well, Richard, what's your final take?
Well, I don't know how deep you want to get into this, but I have a problem with something. A recent message I came across, I'd say about 3 or 4 days ago, that either the original name of Ellen was Yelena. It had a Y in the front and an A at the end. Okay.
Yeah, I understand it. That's what Ellen or Leonid named it.
Well, yeah, but
Russian,
there's significance to that name, and I'll tell you what it is if you want to go that deep, Marshall.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it got my eye because my wife's name is Yelena.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I did a search on that name.
It's the light.
And, you know, and it's a Russian name, of course. But I did a search on that name, and you'd think that, you know, you can get just about anything. If I typed in that name, how come I didn't get a web page talking about how to cook a Russian goose or, you know, how to drive a cab in Russia? But you know what came up?
What?
You won't believe this. Technical papers on the properties. A scientific paper written by a scientist called by that name. Technical papers dealing with the rotation qualities of a white dwarf. Let that sink in a minute.
Woo. Woo.
If you type in that name, what I got out of it almost immediately, I'm talking about the top of the search engine, was technical papers dealing with the properties of rotating black holes, rotating white dwarfs, and the rotating jet qualities, jet being the emissions or material emissions and also magnetic properties. So, you know, you see that and you say, whoa, what's going on here? So that's my
ask.
Why? Why would, you know, I don't get it if it's just a comic.
Just seems to follow in line with elites getting their jollies. You know, they know they've got most of the folks out there confused. Terrell's absolutely spot on. He nailed it. You know, this is in a global cataclysm. The people that are going to do the bulk of the dying are the ones who just don't see it coming. And if they're dumb lucky and they survive it, they're again going to be the ones that do most of the dying after the event, because they're not going to be prepared for surviving. And it's going to whittle down the population pretty darn quick. And with oil infrastructure, energy infrastructure decimated, and it will be, the fact of the matter is food production, even if we could maintain food production at current levels, could only feed at tops maybe half the life on the planet. And the rest of the people are going to know hunger and death in a horrible way. And for those of you who can't imagine it, you ought to read a book called The 900 Days. And it is about the siege of Leningrad during World War II. That city had 1 million people starved to death by the Nazis. They laid siege to it for 900 days. And, you know, I'll never forget, you know, whenever time I hear people talk about, you got to get gold, you got to get silver, you got to get gold, you got to get silver. Again with them damn gold brokers. Well, I met this one gal, and she got to know me and like me, took me in her confidence, and finally she, it was the day before I was coming back to the U.S. I had travel business. I was doing tours, planning setup stuff, you know, go out and site visits and the not. And we were just sitting there having tea, and she brought out a box. I opened it up, and I looked in there. And good God, I've never seen so many gold Rolexes in my life. Rings, bracelets, and it was all the real stuff. I mean, my God, she had a fortune in that box. And I said, why don't you just sell it and do something with it? Go out and have a spree. Enjoy what's left of your life. And she said, no, it's my shame. It's why I keep it. I said, it's your shame? And she said, yeah. During the siege of Leningrad, she worked in the bakeries. And at that time, the bakeries were mixing sawdust with the flour so that they could bake more bread. And if you came up to the counter with your little coupon, she'd be the one slicing it. And for a gold Rolex encrusted with diamonds, you got a little extra thick slice, a few more grams of sawdust. Now, the point here is take what it cost to buy that gold Rolex or a watch half as nice. And instead of waiting to trade it for sawdust, use that money to go to the store and to buy the supplies and get them now. While everybody else is out there going, oh, gold and silver, you know, it's blue light special thinking. All right, everyone's doing that. While they're doing that, you very quietly just go in there and you start getting canned goods and staples and everything, and as much as you can. Not only for yourself, but set aside some for strangers. Because you're going to come into situations where if you haven't got a cavern like Terrell does, way underground, you're going to have to deal with that. People showing up hungry at your door. What are you going to do? How do you turn them away? What happens when they find out you got something? Those are the kind of things you should be thinking about now. So, gentlemen, I think we have really had a great show, a good kickoff to this series. And I look forward to the next time we do it. And when we have something to talk about, we will. That's for sure. And with that, I'm going to close the show. And again, I want to thank each of you, Ed,
Marshall,
Richard,
Marshall,
and Tara.
Marshall, you didn't give me a chance to give my final word.
Oh my God. Okay.
I'll
go fast. Please.
Okay.
Oh, no, you don't have to. You know,
surviving this thing is a 3-step process. You need to identify the threat, you need to create the contingency plans, and then you need to know when to execute them. If you fail any of those three, then you're not going to survive this. My motto is you're hoping for the best and you're preparing for the worst. Okay, you need your food, your water purification, your survival supplies, your guns, your ammo. And then if anything's left, you have paper assets, put that into small denomination silver for barter. Those who have little resources, they say, well, I don't have much money. You put your money into water purification. It's very important because people are going to pay through the nose for one glass of water. That's coming.
That's right.
Okay, you're planning for an extended camping trip. That's what you're planning for. This particular threat, you're required to go underground. You just have to find out how to do it. Those who want to survive, you're going to find a way. More people are going to die from bad water after this event than all the other events combined. From every other reason, they're going to die from bad water. Okay, go down to the drugstore while you can. Get acidophilus for your stomach. Keep those pills. You get $5 for 100 of them. One pill can save your life whenever you kill all the bacteria in your stomach. More people are going to die that way than any other way after this event. So you need to do that. Mm-hmm. Get that into your survival supply. And then the people that are going to come to harm you, they're not the government. They're not the Chinese. They're not all these other boogeymen that they're trying to create for you. The people that are going to come to get you are going to be hungry. And that's why you need a group. You need a large group so that you can watch each other's back. Because as soon as you go to, you try to hole up as a small group, this has happened before with Argentina and other societies that have collapsed. Small groups get destroyed. They get run over by hordes of people that are hungry. That's why you need a survival group. You need a great plan to be able to survive this. And find shelter in a cavern.
That's right. And if you don't have a group now, get extra supplies so that you can pull one together. And, Daryl, in terms of radiation, because that's going to be a real problem, as closing thought, tell folks what you think that they can do for, we talk about it at length in Planet X Forecast 2012 Survival Guide. But what are some of the easy, fast things that you could do for somebody that if they're not in a position where they can survive in place, they have to survive on the move? How do they deal with that?
No, sir. The way that you survive the solar storms, if you're talking about solar radiation, is you have to be underground. That's why the elites are going underground. You can't just be walking around outside. The magnetosphere is going to collapse, going to totally collapse. It's going to be stretched thin like spaghetti behind the Earth. And the people in the southern hemisphere are going to be looking at 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 days of one day because of the way the Earth is tipped backwards of solar storms. And you have to be deep in a cavern. That's the only answer that I know. If somebody knows a better answer, then let's hear it, because the only thing that I can see in my survival plan is to get underground.
That's it. And it's literally about putting as much dirt over your dirt, rock, steel, and whatever. As much density over your head as you can, because then when the radiation comes, that's where it comes. It comes straight down. It does not, like heavy rain, it doesn't fall sideways from time to time. It's all going to come straight down on you. So wherever you are out there, even in your normal daily life, start being aware of places where when there's a radiation storm, a solar flare, because that's one of the things that we have always seen, we've always talked about as a main threat. And I'll give you one tip we talk about in our book, and that is your cell phone is a great way to look around. You know, when you're at school, you're at work, you're at the mall, these are places you're likely going to be when these things pop. And walk around the outside with your cell phone, see how many bars of reception you get. Then walk inside the building and go to different places inside the building, and if you find one where you get zero bars of reception, remember it, because that is going to be, in that building, probably about the safest place you're going to get. And, you know, it's good to get as far underground and away from this as you can, but my strategy has always been, it's the little things. And if you can do enough of the little things, it makes a big difference. And I agree with Terrell about the acidophilus and making sure you can do water. These are terrible ways for people to die. Terrible ways for people to die. And you just don't want to do that. And it is avoidable. So with that, fellas, I think we're pretty much a wrap here on this first show. And we will keep following it. I welcome everyone to join us on the Planet X Town Hall. And there you will see, if you scroll on down to my topics for Marshall Masters, I have a heading there for the research team. Jump on in, share your information. It's free to join, but we are very firm about the requirements. You need to be straightforward with us. And with that, gentlemen, and to everyone, my motto, destiny comes to those who listen, and fate finds the rest. So learn what you can learn, do what you can do, and never give up hope. And this is Marshall for the team saying, we want to see you on the backside.